This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters. I'm Lee Chui Lin. He's been called the true ninja of sustainability. Sir Jonathan Porritt is an environmentalist with a glowing list of accolades from more than 40 years of work dedicated to the field of environmental sustainability. Founder, director, and trustee of Forum for the Future, Sir Jonathan's also the co-chair of the High Carbon Stock Study, a comprehensive, independent, and scientifically robust study which hopes to enable oil palm to be grown more sustainably. He joins me now to discuss the results of the study which has just been launched. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
You were known as the Blair government's critical friend on environmental policy during your tenure as chairman of the UK Sustainable Development Commission. What was it like working as the outsider on the inside of Whitehall?
I found it absolutely fascinating. A combination of real pleasure when it was possible to get sometimes quite difficult advice through to government ministers and persuade them that this really would help them deliver the objectives they had and make for better decision-making, and then real frustration when things just got stuck in the kind of labyrinthine world of Whitehall, of civil services the world over. So it was, it was a very interesting experience, but I must say it certainly taught me a lot about how governments do and don't work, depending on different circumstances.
You're now on the outside again, working through Forum for the Future, an organization which I understand emerged from the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. Could you share that story?
Yes, it did indeed. Because up until then, in 1992, I'd spent the first sort of 20 years of my life as a campaigner in the Green Party and in Friends of the Earth, basically. And I'd found it increasingly difficult just to go on pointing out problems and pointing the finger of blame at other people, and went to the Earth Summit thinking to myself, I've got to find a different way of doing this, because otherwise I'm just going to run out of the kind of energy you need to do work at that level of intensity. And the Earth Summit was amazing. It just showed me that there were people in every walk of life, in business, in education, in the trade unions, in women's groups, the faith groups. There was a huge faith conference in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. So I came back and said, okay, this is going to be solutions from now on. However hard that's going to be, I'm going to devote my life to kind of promoting solutions rather than pointing at the problems, which I think people are more and more familiar with.
And from what I understand, your work is now quite closely aligned with businesses and governments around the world in order to solve these complex challenges. Could you tell me how that cooperation really plays out in real-life terms?
Yes, it's interesting because these are wicked problems, as it were, and really difficult for individual organizations to sort out, to solve on their own. So to give you one example, we do a lot of work with companies in the shipping industry, obviously a very important, huge global industry, very big in Southeast Asia. And we spend a lot of time with individual companies, not just all the shipping owners, but people who are chartering ships, financing ships, etc. So the whole supply chain, as it were. And the idea really is to work with a coalition of willing partners, people who want to make the shipping industry more sustainable quicker than they would otherwise be inclined to do. So our job is to bring them together, to provide the stimulation, the content, the provocation, the support, because these are often quite difficult processes that we're asking them to get involved in. And by working together, it's just so much easier to make things happen faster than working on their own.
You know, so how did your experience working within government inform how you could kind of bring that knowledge out to businesses, as well as trying to make, you know, both parties kind of align their interests and understand that they can work in the same direction?
A sustainable development, it's a big idea, sustainable development, because it's all about the environment, it's about people and communities, and of course it's about the economy. And the difference between just doing straight environmentalism and doing sustainable development, which is what we do in Forum for the Future, is that you can always find an economic rationale for making these things work. There's always a very strong business case or a very strong economic case from a government perspective. And what I've found over the years is that as long as you can align your concerns about the environment with other people's concerns about community, social justice, economic prosperity, whatever it might be, as long as you can get these things aligned in the same track, in the same direction, it is possible to get people to come on board with things that otherwise they wouldn't want to do. And I think that doing the Sustainable Development Commission for 9 years showed me that you can't really work with government ministers unless you can help them a bit in their problems and their challenges. You have to kind of, it's almost like you're getting a quid pro quo for something. If you can give a little bit here, then you can get a bit there, and then you can find that sweet spot between what it is you're trying to achieve together.
Earlier you mentioned the shipping industry, but another area in which, in which this collaboration between business and government is very clear, is the palm oil industry, which you're currently working with as co-chair of the High Carbon Stock Study. Some of the largest companies in the global palm oil supply chain signed the Sustainable Palm Oil Manifesto back in January 2014. What does that mean? What did they commit themselves to?
Those companies, and they are indeed some of the biggest in the industry, based here in Singapore, KL, and in Jakarta. Those companies were already doing a lot. They're already all members of the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. They were very aware of the expectations of them now in terms of selling their oil as certified sustainable oil into Western markets. So it's not that they were behind the game. They weren't. They're already pretty much ahead of what was happening in the industry anyway. But there were two things that really were very difficult. The first was, how do you define the forest that needs to be absolutely protected in terms of the carbon locked up in it? And secondly, how do you do more to help look after smallholders and, in particular, the communities that are dependent on palm oil for their livelihoods? And the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil had found it very difficult to push processes along fast enough on carbon and smallholders. So the Sustainable Palm Oil Manifesto, when they signed up to that, set itself the first objective to produce this high carbon stock study, which essentially is a science-based rationale for determining which forests are available for conversion, not just to the oil palm, of course, but also for rubber, other crops. So which forests can be converted and which forests have to be absolutely protected because they're so important in terms of carbon and greenhouse gases and so important in terms of conservation and biodiversity. And that's really what we spent the last year doing, is seeking to bring the best scientific insights to bear on that knotty problem, because people don't agree about this, as you can imagine. It's a pretty controversial area, and there are quite a lot of people out there who think that not one more tree in Indonesia, Malaysia, or anywhere else should be cut down. And there are quite a lot of people out there who think that these trees are there to be cut down so that people can actually make wealth from the land that becomes available for agriculture. So I've been living with extremes, if I can put it like that, over the last last 18 months, and trying to find how best to reconcile those conflicting interests.
When we talk about the kinds of forests and areas that should be protected, part of that is determining what high carbon stock forests are. What, in your view, constitutes that exactly?
In the kind of forests that we have out here in Southeast Asia, in particular, so in some parts of Malaysia still, in Sabah and Sarawak, but particularly in Indonesia, a lot of the forest landscape now is quite fragmented. It's not whole great swathes of forest. There is still a lot of that left, but a lot of it is fragmented. And the story really is to work out which parts, which areas in those provinces can be usefully developed, can be converted for oil palm, say, and which really now ought to be set aside and protected. And our technical committee, the seven scientists who did all the really hard work on this, they came up with two thresholds, and they're really important thresholds. The first is any forest above a certain amount of carbon locked up in the forest, and the threshold is 75 tons of carbon per hectare. Any forest above that, off-limits, must be protected because of, if you cut it down, so much greenhouse gas is put up into the atmosphere. Forests below that should be available for conversion, but that new development has to be done in a carbon-neutral way. So it has to be planted up, developed in such a way that net emissions from the deforestation that happens, from the conversion that happens, and the planting of the oil palms, and the protection of special areas that are then set aside, you end up with what is called net zero emissions, no emissions going into the atmosphere. So those are two pretty tough thresholds, to be honest. I mean, this is a tough challenge for the industry, and we've had a lot of long arguments, of course, with the industry, who say, well, that's going to make it so hard to do new development in many parts of Indonesia and Malaysia. And we're saying, well, probably, but the world needs to find a way now of reducing deforestation while simultaneously protecting the economic rights of countries like Indonesia and Malaysia and the economic entitlements of some of the poorest people in the world still, because, you know, we're still looking at a huge number of very poor people who have an expectation that they can improve their lives through palm oil and other crops. So that's the trick. You have to define the threshold at the point where you can still have legitimate, very careful, responsible development, but you do simultaneously need to try and reduce deforestation to the absolute minimum.
I'm speaking today with Sir Jonathan Porritt, Founder Director and Trustee of Forum for the Future, as well as the co-chair of the High Carbon Stock Study, which is the topic of today's show. And up next, I want to hear a little bit more about the traffic light system, specifically the amber light area. You are listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Joining me over the phone today, Sir Jonathan Porritt, Founder, Director and Trustee of the Forum for the Future, as well as co-chair of the High Carbon Stock Study, which is what we're discussing today. So we've talked about what a high carbon stock forest is, as well as, you know, how you kind of have to try and balance the interests of corporations as well as the interests of the people living on the land and then environmental interests. So with this system in place, I understand that there is a traffic light system, and the red zone is quite easily defined. The green zone is quite easily defined. We've kind of talked that through. But what about the amber area?
Yes, it's always the amber area that causes yes. the problems. Well, just imagine, if you can, for a moment, that you're standing there looking out over a big expanse of mixed forest and area that is sort of very scrubby, some kind of savanna grassland. Imagine you've got 50,000 hectares in front of you, all a bit like looking like that. And the red bit, as you say, is the stuff that has to be protected. It's such important forest because of conservation values or very high levels of carbon stock. It's just off limits. So that's the bit that's protected. The green area is all the scrubby bits, the grassland, brilliant for planting oil palm, because as soon as you plant it, you actually take in more CO2 than was in that area before. So those, as you say, are the easy bits. The amber bit is tricky, because that's where you need to do some of the conversion. And what that means is that you will be causing some deforestation. And usually it's deforestation of what is known as young regenerating forest. These are areas that have been worked over before, they've been logged or developed before, but the forest is coming back. It's growing back again after that former use. And the trick is to get the balance between the green bits, where you're causing carbon to be sequestered, the red bits, where you're causing carbon to be saved, and more carbon to be taken into the forest that is being protected. And then you balance that against the amber zone, where you're actually cutting trees down to plant the oil palm. And the idea is that you do this detailed analysis of your 50,000 hectares. You gauge which areas have to be completely protected, which areas are brilliant for planting, which areas will entail some deforestation. And then looking at your carbon maps, because you can get a really detailed readout, if you like, of how much carbon is in each part of your 50,000 hectare concession, you can develop enough land to make a very viable, economically viable palm oil development, and at the same time you can make it carbon neutral.
So now that the results of the study have been launched, now that we understand that there is a red, green and amber zone, and these are no-goes, these are okay, how will the results be used in practice by the palm oil industry? How will this impact how people grow?
All the signatories to this Sustainable Palm Oil Manifesto agreed nearly 2 years ago now that they would trial whatever it was that we came up with in our study. And that's important because this is new. This is This is quite difficult stuff for companies to have to adopt. There are all sorts of additional ideas in there as well. We've only talked about the carbon, but there's lots of stuff about improving the welfare of people, making sure we do a better job looking after smallholders and so on. So there's a lot of other things in there, which is why it's really important to trial it, because you can't just go from a methodology that's been worked out, as it were, not in situ, but in theory. You have to trial that, and you have to see what that would look like on the ground. And that's why we did a case study, a detailed case study in Gabon, in West Africa, and we looked at what would happen in that country, which is developing now, quite large amounts of land for oil palm. And we believe now that demonstrated viability, so that these companies can now test it out here in Malaysia, in Indonesia, perhaps in countries like Gabon or Liberia. And those trials will then form the basis on which I hope the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil will develop a new standard for defining high carbon stock.
I understand that there's also another study by environmental groups, including Greenpeace and the Forest Trust, who are working with palm oil giant Golden Agri Resources on a separate approach, but also focused on forest carbon stocks. How do the two studies differ?
Yes, this other study is called the High Carbon Stock Approach. So our methodology is called High Carbon Stock Plus, and theirs is called High Carbon Stock Approach. It is confusing, this. And we have many, many areas in common. We're strongly in agreement on a lot of the issues about measurement, the tools that you need to use, about the socioeconomic benefits that can be achieved, about the importance of existing standards, assessment procedures, free, prior, and informed consent. Almost everything we agree on. What we don't agree on is the threshold, if you like, the point at which conversion is deemed to be possible or impossible, conversion for oil palm. And the HCS approach, the high carbon stock approach, sets their threshold at a much, much tougher level than we do, if you like. They don't believe that any young regenerating forest should be developed at all. They think all that forest should be protected. They don't say anything about carbon neutral, so that's an extra dimension that we bring to bear on this. But they would set that threshold in a different place from us. And if you look at what they're actually talking about in terms of the kinds of forest which would be protected under the HCS approach, their threshold is closer to 35, 45, maybe 50 tons of carbon per hectare. Ours is set higher at 75 tons of carbon per hectare, which means that more land is available for conversion. That's the principal difference. Not the only difference, but it's the principal difference. And we are now working really hard with them to work out how to bring these two different methodologies together, how to converge, because the industry does not want two different ways of addressing this same thorny issue. They want just one standard, which they can then rely on to help them develop new areas in future.
With all the information that's coming through from the study, as well as all the different ideas and methodologies that could be brought to bear, are you optimistic that we can save forests and produce palm oil in a sustainable manner?
I absolutely am. Yes, I have no doubt about this. In fact, it's one of the things I feel most confident about, because it seems to me that this is a crucially important economic crop for this region and other parts of the world, for West Africa. I've just mentioned Gabon, but other countries in West and Central Africa. It's a really valuable crop from the perspective of the global economy, because it's so efficient. You can produce so much of it per hectare in comparison to other oils, competitor oils. So we need it. We need it globally. We need it in terms of different sectors, and countries need it to help them improve the livelihoods of millions of people in those countries. So I don't doubt that the demand for the oil will continue, for palm oil will continue, and that companies now are ready to produce that oil in more sustainable ways. And I'm absolutely convinced now, when I look at best practice in the industry, the companies that are doing it really well, that if we could raise the performance of the industry as a whole, within 5 to 10 years, there isn't any reason at all why this industry wouldn't be achieving some of the highest sustainability standards of any land-based, agriculture-based industry in the world. And I see an appetite for that. I see a readiness for that, which, to be honest, doesn't really exist. If I think about what the soybean industry is doing in America or South America, they don't, you know, they don't bother about any of this stuff, to be honest. This is something that's pretty special out here in this part of the world. And this industry has an opportunity now to demonstrate how you can achieve that reconciliation, continue to use a legitimate form of economic development to help with alleviating poverty, with growing economic opportunity, but do it in a way that is very responsible environmentally and socially.
Of course, a lot of this has been coming up in our headlines because with the annual haze plaguing our Asian skies, the palm oil industry has been coming under a lot of fire, pardon the pun, for being the root cause of forest burning activities. Is zero deforestation ever going to be a possibility?
I think this year's haze, the burning season, has just shocked everybody and reminded us all how crucial it is now to find solutions to these problems. And we've yet to get the detailed analysis about the origins of those fires, where they were predominantly being caused. Were they coming from big companies, smallholders, whatever it might be? We still need to see exactly what the breakdown of responsibility looks like. For what it's worth, the big companies that we're dealing with were very much supportive of trying to put all these fires out. They're not the principal cause of the haze these days. But the industry as a whole still has to acknowledge that, as far as the world is concerned, the burning of huge acreages of forest and peat is a massive scar on the industry. And we have to get that sorted out. There's no way the industry can hold up its head high with pride in the world, in the global economy, if it cannot help sort out this issue about the annual burn, the annual haze, as you put it. And I know a lot of these companies now are saying, okay, we've got to be much more proactive in bringing forward solutions to these problems. We've got to work with some of these smallholders to help them avoid burning. If they want to convert their land, they ought to be able to convert it using bulldozers or mechanical means rather than burning it. How do we help with that? How do we stop some of the fires before they really catch light? How do we protect some of these peat areas? And I think there's now a readiness to become a bigger part of the solution than was the case before, because it's an absolutely shocking thing. Every year it happens. This year was particularly shocking. But unless new stuff happens, it's going to happen all over again next year. And we'll all be kind of holding our head in our hands saying, how did that happen?
The industry is one thing, but there were also a lot of intergovernmental discussions. You're better placed than most to comment on how governments can tackle the environment. Is it possible to get sustainable development accepted across governments?
It's difficult, but I do see some really encouraging signs. And one of those is that it may be harder to make these sustainable development solutions work at the national level than to make them work at the state level or the provincial level. And one of the most exciting things happening right now in Indonesia and in Malaysia is that a number of Indonesian provinces and the state of Sabah here in Malaysia are beginning to look at statewide or province-wide solutions to these problems, to take a much broader integrated land use perspective. And that's happening, for instance, in South Sumatra, in central Kalimantan, and as I said, in the state of Sabah. And what that means is the government then begins to work in a completely different way with industry, with NGOs, with stakeholders, with people responsible for other kinds of land use, not just agriculture, but forestry and so on. And they begin to work out how you can get this best result from thinking through land use policies in a much clearer way. The state of Sabah, for instance, would love to increase the total protected area from 30%, I think it is now, that they've committed to. They'd love to increase that to 40%. How can they do that and yet still have a responsible, completely sustainable, certified palm oil industry across the state as a whole? Now, I think those statewide, province-wide attempts involving government committed to sustainability, best practice industry committed to sustainability, NGOs and local communities committed to sustainability, I think that's the way forward. And nobody in Kuala Lumpur or Jakarta is going to sit there and say, oh, no, we're not going to have any of that. It's all got to be done nationally or not at all, because honestly, governments have to get wise to this. It's sometimes easier to do this stuff at the smaller regional level than it is to do it nationally.
Having said that, as we speak, COP21 is still ongoing. What are your hopes for the outcome of the conference?
Well, I'm actually quite hopeful on that score, too. I know you think you'd come across a very rare beast here.
Just a complete optimist, yeah.
Actually, there are a lot of things that do make me quite depressed. But right now, watching the last days of the conference in Paris, it's already achieved a lot, even if nothing else happened over the remaining hours left to those negotiators. I think people would probably say it was by far the best outcome we'd had for a very long time from one of these conferences. And I'm pretty confident that they'll go further than they've gone so far. The readiness on the part of more than 100 countries now to make really serious commitments to reducing the emissions of greenhouse gases to this decarbonization story. The presence of big business in Paris has been amazing. Really ambitious commitments being made by global companies. NGOs working very hard across Paris to influence both governments and business. Yes, we've got some real problems, of course, in terms of countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia and others that are just proving as hard as ever. But the will, the determination on the part of the majority of countries now to make solutions stick is unprecedented, in my opinion, unprecedented. And so, yep, I'm definitely more on the optimistic side at the moment than I am on the other side of that particular line. If you want to come back to me in a couple of days' time and ask me whether I'm still in that same place, fine. I think it should be okay this time round.
Well, you know, continuing our theme of optimism, and it's very rare that I get to do an environmental interview and end on a high note, so I'm just going to go, I'm rolling with it. You've said in numerous interviews that it doesn't work to tell people that we're heading towards the apocalypse. You know, you wrote the book, The World We Made, as a deliberate attempt to combat environmental gloom. Could you elaborate?
Yes. Well, having been in this world for 40 years, it became perfectly apparent to me about 20 years ago that if you beat people up with images of doom and gloom and despair, it doesn't leave people feeling very inspired to do anything about it, particularly young people who really do not want to hear that their prospects of a good life are all but over before they're 20 years old. That's no way to get young people involved and excited and inspired. And people don't need to feel like that anyway. We have left it late. We've wasted decades kind of doing really stupid economic development rather than really sensible economic development. But we haven't left it too late. And that's because we've still got amazing technologies now to help generate the energy that we need to produce an equitable, sustainable energy solution for every single human being on this planet in the next 2-3 decades max. That's an incredible revolution that is already unfolding in our lives right now. So if you start with the technology, you look at the fact that investors now want to put their money into something more intelligent than just the next wretched coal mine or gas-fired power station. They, too, want to be a part of the solution. And then you look at what young people are saying. And they're saying, for God's sake, get this together. Come on. We've looked at the reality of what happens if you go on trashing the environment for the last 20, 30 years. We know we need to do it differently now. These are powerful, very, very positive, very constructive forces in our life, and they don't mean the end of the things that we love. They don't mean that we have to stop having a good time. They don't mean that we'll all now just live utterly miserable lives without being able to do some of the things we cherish and love and be with people in the way we love. It means we'll actually have a better life, but a life that protects the interests of future generations as well as improves our life. And that's really what sustainable development is, very simply.
For more information on the High Carbon Stock Study, visit carbonstockstudy.com. Thank you very much for speaking with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with Sir Jonathan Porritt, Founder Director and Trustee of Forum for the Future and Co-Chair of the High Carbon Stock Study, which is what we've been discussing today, among many other wonderfully optimistic things. You've been listening today to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.